Welcome to the APA Podcast, where we help one another follow Jesus at home, in our city, and around the world.
Hello. Good morning. My name is Nick, and I'm one of the pastors here at APA. And it's a privilege to be a part of this church family. Yesterday, I got to spend some extra time with many of you at our work bee. We had 60 plus people meet here at the church on a rainy day to do work together. We had people cleaning moss off of the ceiling, or not ceiling, roof, that makes more sense. We had people fixing baseboards and railings. We had people cleaning in the kitchen and even washing the walls. Those walls are so clean, you could eat off of them. I don't know how that would work, but I'm telling you, you could if you found a way. And a special shout out to the people who are working with me outside, weeding the garden beds, pulling grass where it didn't belong, pruning shrubs, and making this property sparkle. All while it poured rain. It was great. I've even got a picture of probably the best volunteers. There's me and my son. We did so much. Liam built an anthill, is what he, a home for ants. I don't know why, but apparently we needed that at our church. So it was so much fun to be a part of. And on behalf of our team, we just want to say a huge thank you to all that came out to help care for this space. Now today I have the privilege of diving into our final series in Genesis, exploring the story of Joseph. I love the story of Joseph. It's always been one of my favorites, but realistically, this story should scare me. I'm the eldest child of my family, so my natural inclination isn't to identify with Joseph, but with his brothers instead. Being annoyed by the antics of those younger than me, seeing all of their special treatment while I had it so much harder, the injustice of it all. Anybody with me, eldest children? It reminds me of my curfew growing up. I had throughout high school a curfew of 9 p.m. I could not be out later, and I remember getting ready to graduate, and my friends were putting on a party, and I was like, Mom and Dad, can I go to this party? It's going to be after 9 p.m. And so they graciously allowed me to stay out until 11 p.m. I was the first kid home. We were all like Christian kids. There was nothing nefarious going on. And then my brother, a couple of years later. It was just a regular weeknight, and he was out until 2 a.m. with his friends just a couple of years later. Explain to me how this is fair. Now, if you have further questions about this, my parents are sitting right over there. I'm sure you could get a good understanding of what happened. But I empathize with Joseph's brothers, and on top of all of the favoritism, they're told that Joseph will be greater than them, that they'll bow down to him. I definitely don't love the idea of bowing down to one of my younger siblings, and realistically, I don't think I would have sold them into slavery for all of that, but still, I understand the frustration. But even as an eldest child, identifying with the brothers rather than Joseph, I still love this story. And I love it because of this part of the passage that we're entering into now. Today we're going to be looking at Genesis 43 and 44. And for these two chapters, the main character of the story actually switches. It's no longer focused on Joseph and what he's doing, but instead becomes about one of the brothers, Judah. It's about a very flawed man who surrenders his life in order to do what is right and receives an incredible inheritance as a result. Now, we have a lot of text to cover today, so rather than taking the next 15 minutes just to read chapters 43 and 44, I'm going to do my best to summarize the events that take place so that we have time to really dive deep into the key verses. But I encourage you to read through these passages for yourselves. Dive deep into the intricacies of the story because it's rich and full of meaning. Now, looking at Genesis 43, we see that the brothers have returned to the land of Canaan with their food. They had to leave their brother Simeon behind, but they have brought temporary salvation to their family, the ability to continue to eat and live for a time. But the famine continues to rage on. They need more food in order to survive. And so Jacob said to his sons, "Go back and buy us a little more food." Now here Judah is the one who responds to Jacob, the father. Now this is an important detail because right before this in chapter 42, Reuben, the firstborn, is the one who talks to their father Jacob, explaining what they need to do in order to get more food. But now it's pivoted away from Reuben and instead to Judah, the fourthborn, who takes the lead speaking for his brothers. Now there are two key reasons as to why this is so important. The first is that Judah isn't the firstborn of the family, and yet he's clearly portrayed as the one who takes the lead, the one who is able to get things done, the true leader of his brothers. The second thing it does is it establishes Judah as the central figure in this part of the story. Chapter 43 begins with Judah as the main character, and then later in chapter 44, we see that Judah again continues to be the one to speak for his brothers, for his family. And so Judah, the main character of this little story, convinces his father Jacob to send Benjamin, the youngest favorite son, with them to Egypt so that they can get more food. And Judah does this by saying, "I personally guarantee his safety. You may hold me responsible if I don't bring him back to you. Then let me bear the blame forever." And so the brothers set off back to Egypt with gifts and the money that was returned to them to ensure that they find favor with this Egyptian official, who we know is Joseph. And so as the brothers approach Egypt, Joseph sees that Benjamin is with them, and he immediately tells his servant to prepare a big feast for them. And when the servant goes to invite Joseph's brothers to the feast, they try to pay back the money that Joseph secretly gave them. But the servant says that he has already received their money and brushes it off, saying, "Your God, the God of your father, must have put this treasure into your sacks." The brothers then dine with Joseph and have a great feast. This brings us to chapter 44, where Joseph devises yet another test for his brothers. If you have your Bible, we're going to read from verses 1 to 13 in the New Living Translation. When his brothers were ready to leave, Joseph gave these instructions to his palace manager. "Fill each of their sacks with as much grain as they can carry and put each man's money back into his sack. Then put my personal silver cup at the top of the youngest brother's sack along with the money for his grain." So the manager did as Joseph instructed him. The brothers were up at dawn and were sent on their journey with their loaded donkeys. But when they had gone only a short distance and were barely out of the city, Joseph said to his palace manager, "Chase after them and stop them. When you catch up with them, ask them, 'Why have you repaid my kindness with such evil? Why have you stolen my master's silver cup, which he uses to predict the future? What a wicked thing you have done.'" And so when the palace manager caught up with the men, he spoke to them as he had been instructed. "What are you talking about?" the brothers responded. "We are your servants and would never do such a thing. Didn't we return the money we found in our sacks? We brought it back all the way from the land of Canaan. Why would we steal silver or gold from your master's house? If you find his cup with any one of us, let that man die, and all the rest of us, my lord, will be your slaves." Isn't that crazy? I can't say that my natural response to being accused of stealing something would be to offer to be killed if it was in fact true. But the brothers are that confident that they've done nothing wrong. "And so that's fair," the man replied, "but only the one who stole the cup will be my slave. The rest of you may go free." They all quickly took their sacks from the backs of their donkeys and opened them. The palace manager searched the brothers' sacks from the oldest to the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. When the brothers saw this, they tore their clothing in despair, just like their father Jacob had torn his clothing when he found out that Joseph was no longer with them. Then they loaded their donkeys again and returned to the city. When I picture this moment in my mind, I see the brothers all like hunched over and dragging their feet, probably telling their donkeys to stop moving so quickly. It's almost comical in my mind. It reminds me of Christmas morning as a kid. You're having the best day ever. Your parents bring out this massive present and you rip open the box and all you find are plain white socks. Anybody been there? And for a moment, you have hope that there's more. Maybe this is a prank. Maybe there's something at the bottom of the box and you reach down, you pull something up with pride and it's plain white underwear, which you have just displayed to everyone. You've gone from the highest of highs to the lowest of lows in just a few short moments. And if you think about it, that's exactly what has happened to Joseph's brothers. They just went from the best day ever to the worst day ever. They just had a big feast. They got the food they needed to save their family. Their younger brother Benjamin is safe, and they finally have a big win. And then it all turns downhill in a single moment. They're dragging their feet on the way back to Egypt, awaiting what can only be called their Christmas socks and underwear moment. Does anyone else feel frustrated with Joseph at this point? I mean, what is he doing? Why is he hatching all of these convoluted schemes? What is the point of all of this? Well, the answer is actually really simple. See, Joseph isn't being cruel. He's not looking to get revenge on his brothers. He's actually showing them grace. Joseph longs to reconcile with his brothers. He longs to restore their relationship, to share with them how God has used all that has happened to him, the good, the bad, the ugly, all for the glory of God. But for true reconciliation to occur, Joseph needs to know if his brothers have changed. He wants to know if they are still the brothers who would sell him as a slave, or if they've grown to be better people. So Joseph sets up this test in a way that it closely resembles what happened in Genesis 37 when he was sold into slavery. And he's asking questions like, will they allow harm to come to Benjamin, the youngest son, just like they did to me? Will they prioritize their own lives and bring grief to their father, just like they did when they sold me? Will they cover what happened with lies and deceit, just like they did when they took my cloak and dipped it in goat's blood? Will they do what they've done before, or when given the chance to do it all over again, will they make the righteous choice, the others-focused choice? The circumstance for the test hasn't really changed. They are still 10 brothers pitted against their half-brother. Their father, Jacob, has made it very clear that Benjamin is the favorite. Think about how Jacob talked to them in chapter 42. When the brothers said that they needed to take Benjamin to Egypt to get more food, Jacob replied, "My son will not go down with you. His brother Joseph is dead, and he is all I have left. If anything should happen to him on your journey, you would send this grieving, white-haired man to his grave." Talk about a lack of love for 10 of his sons. I mean, this tells us that the feelings are still there for these 10 brothers. The feelings of neglect, of not being treated fairly, of not being loved, of not being appreciated. And those feelings are closely tied to a person. They're tied to Benjamin, the new favorite son of Jacob. And so this test that Joseph devises creates the same opportunity for those 10 brothers to be rid of the source of their mistreatment and to get away totally free. Ultimately, this test will give us a glimpse into the character of these brothers. Are they the same as they were all those years ago? Or have they changed for the better? So what do we know? What do we know about the character of the 10 brothers? Well, honestly, not too much. The only brother that we have additional information on is Judah. And as we mentioned earlier, Judah is set up as both the leader of his brothers and as the main character in this short narrative. So let's look at what the book of Genesis tells us about Judah. The first time we see Judah is in Genesis is in chapter 37. While the brothers are plotting to kill Joseph, Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain by killing our brother? We'd have to cover up the crime. Instead of hurting him, let's sell him to those Ishmaelite traders. After all, he is our own brother, our own flesh and blood," and his brothers agreed. So our first introduction to Judah isn't great. in the best possible light. He is a leader amongst his brothers, and he's a man with a plan, and those around him listen to him. But he doesn't use his influence for good. Instead, he uses it for personal gain. Judah ensures that the brothers get something out of getting rid of Joseph, and they get to keep their hands clean in the process. So we're introduced to a man who is influential and yet crafty and out for his own good. Growing up, I had always assumed that Judah was being like a good guy here. He was convincing his brothers not to kill Joseph, but Genesis 37 makes it pretty clear that it's Reuben, the firstborn, who wants to act righteously and save Joseph, whereas Judah's actions are selfish. Judah is shown as a leader, the fourthborn child that is listened to by all of his brothers, but he's a leader with compromised righteousness. This is a theme that continues on in Genesis 38. Now, we aren't going to do a deep dive into this chapter in Scripture, as our intent today is to focus on understanding Judah's character, but this story is the story of Judah and Tamar, a story that we haven't looked into in this series to this point. And let me tell you, it is an extremely messy story. If you don't know it, it's weird. It speaks of Judah settling in Canaan, marrying a woman there and having kids. He then finds a wife named Tamar for his firstborn son. But Judah's son does evil in the eyes of the Lord and dies. And so by Hebrew tradition, the secondborn marries Tamar but refuses to give her children, again, doing evil in the eyes of the Lord, and so he dies too. And then Judah, afraid that his third and final son will die too, he gives Tamar empty promises of marrying his youngest son, essentially abandoning Tamar, a vulnerable widow. Tamar then takes things into her own hands, dressing as a prostitute and sleeping with her father-in-law, Judah, providing him a son and establishing herself as part of the family again. Like I said, really, really messy story. There's much that can be said about those who are unjustly marginalized and or abused, and it's a powerful story that speaks importantly to those things. And I wish that I had the time to get in and unpack all of that. But for today, our focus is looking at the character of Judah and how he's presented as a person in this story. Now, there are three key things that we see highlighted. The first is that Judah continues on the same Genesis theme that we've seen ever since Genesis chapter 3. When Eve saw the forbidden fruit looked good, she took it for herself and she ate. This is what Judah does as he settles in Canaan. He sees a beautiful woman outside of the family of Abraham. She is forbidden fruit. See, Judah's responsibility is to see the family of Abraham expand. So he's meant to marry someone within the extended family, but he sees something different. He takes her as his wife, and he lays with her. He saw, he took, he ate. He is shown as a sinful man that values his own desires above the promises of God. The second thing that we see is that he produces children of the same character. They do evil in the eyes of the Lord, and as a result, the Lord puts his two eldest sons to death. The third and final thing that we see is that Judah is confronted by his own lack of righteousness. When Judah finds out that his daughter-in-law Tamar has become pregnant when she's no longer married, he sentences her to death. But Tamar does this grand reveal, proving that it was Judah who had impregnated her. It was his lack of righteousness that caused this to happen. And it was his lack of righteousness in abandoning her in the first place that drove her to these actions. Judah has an aha moment where he says, "She is more righteous than I." And as abruptly as this story begins, it ends. And we're left with the image of a flawed man who is confronted by his own lack of righteousness. The next time we see Judah is in Genesis 43 and 44. Where we find ourselves today, facing a test devised by his brother Joseph to see if his character has changed. So with all of that in mind, let's jump back to Genesis 44. Our story picks back up with the brothers returning to Joseph, dragging their feet. The servant has found the missing cup in Benjamin's sack, and now they need to make amends. Now, Joseph's proposition is that the man who stole the cup becomes his slave, while the rest of the brothers go back in peace. So the brothers are confronted with the same easy out that they had before. Abandon Benjamin, the favored son, the nuisance, the one they are jealous of, and get away totally free. So what do? Well, Judah, as the leader, steps forward and recounts their story in full detail, telling of their travel, telling of their father, and what it would do to their father to lose Benjamin. And then Judah does something radically different. He says in verse 30, "And now, my Lord, I cannot go back to my father without the boy. Our father's life is bound up in the boy's life. If he sees that the boy is not with us, our father will die. We, your servants, will indeed be responsible for sending that grieving, white-haired man to his grave. My Lord, I guaranteed to my father that I would take care of the boy. I told him if I don't bring him back to you, I will bear the blame forever. So please, my Lord, let me stay here as a slave instead of the boy, and let the boy return to his brothers. For how can I return to my father if the boy is not with me? I couldn't bear to see the anguish this would cause my father." Who is this Judah? Because it's not the same one as earlier. This isn't a Judah who puts himself first. Instead, he is thinking first of his father and how he can protect him from grief. And he thinks of his younger brother Benjamin and how he can protect him from a life of slavery. See, this Judah exemplifies self-sacrificial leadership, a self-sacrificial love that prioritizes others at the cost of himself. Does that remind you of anyone? Maybe a really famous Bible character named Jesus? See, in Judah's response, we see a man who has chosen a new way. He has chosen God's way. He has chosen the way of life. One of the big themes that we've seen throughout the Genesis narrative is that humanity is faced with two options. Number one, you can seize control, or two, you can surrender control to God. See, when we seize control, we live out the fall all over again. We see something that we like, we take it, and we eat it, satiating our own desires at the expense of all else. And what does this lead to? Death. It leads to death and destruction. It divorces us from God, driving a wedge between us and our Creator, leaving us bereft of all meaning and purpose. But if instead we choose surrender, giving God ultimate authority over our lives, it leads to life. This is a word for you and I today. Jesus says in Matthew 16, verse 25, "For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it." It's only through surrender that we find life. So what happens after Judah's big moment of sacrifice? Tune in next week. Sorry to leave you on a big cliffhanger like that, but that's what I was told to do. But how I do want to end is by jumping ahead to Genesis 49. In Genesis 49, Jacob gathers all of his sons around him, and he passes on the blessing that God gave to Abraham. He speaks with authority about what is to come for each of his sons. And in verses 8 to 10, we see what Jacob says of Judah. "Judah, your brothers will praise you. You will grasp your enemies by the neck. All your relatives will bow before you. Judah, my son, is a young lion that has finished eating its prey. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down. Like a lioness, who dares to rouse him? The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from his descendants, until the coming of the one to whom it belongs, the one whom all nations will honor." The future of Judah's family is a good one. He will be the leader of his brothers. He is a fierce warrior who will have victory over his enemies, the lion of Judah who rises up against injustice. What an amazing reversal of character. And we know that this is what comes to pass. Judah's line becomes the line of kings of Israel. And in verse 10, we see the prophecy that the Messiah will come from Judah. Jesus is the fulfillment of Judah's lineage, the ultimate lion of Judah who conquers his enemies by becoming as a lamb sacrificed for the sake of others. This is what comes from the life of Judah. The life of a man who for many decades lived primarily for himself, who lived in sin, who lived taking advantage of those around him, and yet, when he was confronted by his own lack of righteousness, was willing to change. He was willing to change. He was willing to surrender his own life for the sake of others, to choose God's way and to choose the way of life. I remember, I guess it's 5 years ago now, being in the hospital after Rachel had just given birth to our eldest son, Liam. We knew what his first name was gonna be, and we were pretty sure he was gonna take our last name, we were pretty sure, but we didn't know what his middle name would be. And so he was here, so we're like, he should probably get a name. And so we pulled out our list of names that we're going between, and the one that kept coming to the top is the name of Judah. And so there Rachel and I were pulling out our Bibles with our new baby beside us, and we started reading these passages, trying to evaluate, do we want our son to have this name? And so we're reading, and he's like, oh, he's selling his brother into slavery, not too good. Oh man, now he's sleeping with his daughter-in-law. Do we really want to speak this over our son's life? And so we were waffling about this, not sure. But then we got to this passage. We got to chapter 44, where all of a sudden, Judah is different. He sacrifices himself for his brothers. And I remember looking at Rachel and us just saying, yes, this is who we want our son to be. And we began to pray over him, knowing that he was going to make a lot of mistakes. We began praying that he would be a strong man who's able to acknowledge his mistakes, move past them, and be willing to change, be willing to take on God's way of doing things instead. And so that's his name, Liam Judah McAllister. After all of the ups and downs of Judah's life, we see that Judah's legacy is full of promise. His choice to change the way that he lives results in a blessing that is carried on for generations, and that through Jesus becomes a blessing not only for his family, but for the whole world. How amazing is that? So where does the story of Judah fit in the bigger picture of Joseph's story? Well, if you've been paying attention, you'll have noticed that there are a lot of sets of twos in this story. Joseph has two dreams. In prison, Joseph interprets the dreams of two men, the cupbearer and the baker, and then Pharaoh has two dreams. Now, theologians and biblical scholars have named this pattern the rule of twos. And it's actually Joseph himself that spells out why these sets of two are so important. When interpreting Pharaoh's dream, he says, "The dreams of Pharaoh are one and the same. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do." These sets of two are given as a confirmation by God that he will do exactly what he has spoken. And that's exactly what we see throughout the story of Genesis. All of those dream interpretations become reality. But the story of Joseph also sets up another set of two. A set of two brothers, Joseph and Judah. Joseph, who goes through incredible suffering, but through all of it, stays surrendered to God's will, serving faithfully and living God's way through every circumstance, and who sees God's blessing as a result. He becomes a person who gives life to others. And then we have Judah, who lives a life of selfishness, who takes the path of the fall, choosing to see, take, and eat, prioritizing his desires above all else, but then changes. He too becomes someone who surrenders to God's will, who lives self-sacrificially, and sees God's incredible blessing as a result. See, the stories of Joseph and Judah are one and the same. God is making it clear that this too will come to pass for you and for me. If we choose to surrender to God's will, we too will receive his life and his blessing. Whether we journey through life like Joseph, unaware of how he will eventually use our faithfulness for his glory, Or we journey through life like Judah, flawed and broken, and yet willing to make a change and to submit to God's way in the end. The story of Judah is a powerful one. If nothing else, my hope is that you would take away these two things. One, there is hope for all of us. Pastor Dave alluded to this last week. For most of us, measuring up to Joseph feels impossible. I mean, let's be honest. If my siblings sold me into slavery, I was wrongly accused of making advances on a woman, thrown into prison, and forgotten about, I would have a hard time continuing to submit my life to God. I honestly don't know that I would be able to live up to the example of Joseph. But Judah, I too have made mistakes. I too have done things that I'm not proud of. I too have lived out the fall, seeing, taking, and eating. But you know what else I can do? You know what else I have done? I've admitted my mistakes. I've tried to do better. And I can, again and again, choose to surrender my life to God. I might need to realistically do that every single day, and maybe more than once a day. But like Judah, this is something I can do. See, there is hope for all of us, which leads to point number two. We are called to surrender. See, what God asks of us is to surrender control to Him, to no longer prioritize ourselves, to not take things into our own hands, to not be people who see, take, and eat, but to surrender to Him. Because in that place, God promises His faithfulness, and God will do what He has spoken. I want to live a life of surrender, and I hope that you do too.
Thank you for listening to the APA podcast. We hope it helps you better follow Jesus in your home, city, and around the world.